Good afternoon. My name is Owen Egan, and I am the chairman of the Freedom of Information Commission. This is the regular meeting of the commission, October 12th, 2022. The public may listen to the meeting in real time by following the instructions listed at the top of the commission's meeting agenda, currently posted on the commission's website. In addition, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. For the benefit of the public, particularly those who may be listening to the meeting by telephone, I'll take a roll call so that the record reflects who is participating today. When I say your name, please indicate that you are present. Commissioner Barry. Commissioner Einhorn. Commissioner Fuseschi.
Here.
Mr. Hankin.
Here.
Mr. Streeter.
Here.
And myself, Chairman Owen Egan, present. Similarly, when the commission conducts a vote, it will be by roll. The first item is consideration of the minutes of the commission meeting of September 28th. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the minutes for adoption of the commission's regular meeting of September 28th, 2022.
Thank you. Motion's been made and seconded. I'll conduct a roll call of those who are in favor. Please say aye. Commissioner Einhorn?
Aye.
Commissioner Fuseschi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next, we will consider the hearing officer's reports. I will call the docket. If you wish to address the commission on a particular docket number, please let me know when I call it and we will mark it ready. We will then take up the cases in the order that they are called. So I'll begin. Docket number FIC 2020-0404, Andre Sosa versus Commissioner, State of Connecticut, Department of Correction et al. Are you there, Mr. Sosa?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to be heard?
Yes, yeah.
Is there anyone there for the State of Connecticut? Yes. Your name? Thank you, Attorney McCurdy. Okay, so we'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2021-0348, Aaron Bouffard versus Chief Police Department, City of Danbury et al. Is Aaron Bouffard or Bouffard there, please? Is there anyone here from the City of Danbury? I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, this was complaint and failed to appear. It was a dismissal. I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn. Commissioner Fuseschi.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number 2020-0634, Greg and Jen Haythorne versus Superintendent of Schools, Weston Public Schools et al. Are Greg and Jen Haythorne here, please? Is there anyone here from Weston Public Schools?
Yeah, Sarah Gleason from Sherman Goodwin.
Thank you. With that, I'd entertain a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, dismissal, seeing that the complainant's not here and there's no objection to the respondent, I move adoption of the hearing officer.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn. Mr. Fuseschi.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Thank you, Attorney Gleason. Next is FIC 2021-0619. Greg and Jennifer Haythorne versus Town Administrator, Town of Weston, et al. Greg and Jennifer Haythorne there, please. Is Attorney Gleason here on this one as well?
No.
Is there anyone here on this one for the Town of Weston? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, another dismissal is the previous case. I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fuzeci?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Chairman Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number 2021-0214, Susan Hay and Associated Press versus Governor, State of Connecticut, Office of the Governor, et al. Is there anyone here from the Associated Press?
Susan Hay.
Okay, would you like to be heard?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anyone here from the State of Connecticut on this matter, the Governor's Office? I guess you're it. All right, we'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2021-0411, Anthony Price versus Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer, Connecticut Innovations, et al. Is there anyone here on that matter?
Yes, Anthony Price.
Okay, would you like that marked ready?
Yes.
All right, is there anyone here from Chief Operating Officer or Chief Financial Officer, Connecticut Innovations?
Yes. Chris, Attorney Chris Cahill, Shipman and Goodwin, on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you, Attorney Cahill. We'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2021-0610, Matthew Hennessy versus Donald Stein, Chair, Materials, Innovation and Recycling Authority, et al. Is Matthew Hennessy here?
Yes.
Would you like to be
Frank
heard?
Frank Dickinson on behalf of Mr. Hennessy.
I'm sorry?
Frank Dickinson on behalf of Mr. Hennessy.
Would you like to be heard?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Attorney Dickinson. Is there anyone else here on that matter? Donald Stein, anyone representing?
Yes, Michael Collins from Heller and Sage representing this time.
Thank you. Thank you. Mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2021-0617, Melissa Steves versus Superintendent of Schools, Humboldt Public Schools, et al. Melissa Steves here, please. Is anyone from the Trumbull Public Schools here, please? I'd entertain a motion. Oh, excuse me.
Before you do that, Mr. Chairman, I do have a small amendment.
Just identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Danielle McGee, I was the hearing officer in this matter.
Thank you, Attorney McGee.
The amendment is with respect to order number one on page 5 of the hearing officer's report. The second date in the order currently reads September 13, 2019, but it should read September 13, 2021. So the 2019 just needs to be changed to 2021.
What number is that again?
The first order on page 5.
Yes.
It's the second date, September 13, 2019, needs to be changed to September
13, 2021. Mr. Chairman, I'll move to amend the hearing officer's report for the request of the hearing officer in the first paragraph of the order.
Second. Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor of the amendment. Commissioner Einhorn? Commissioner Fuzeci?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. The amendment passes unanimously.
Mr. Chairman, seeing no one was here, I move the amended hearing officer's report for adoption.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor of the decision as amended. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fuzeci?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you. Next is FIC 2022-0037, Patricia Confrancesco versus Finance Director, Town of East Haven, et al. Is Patricia Confrancesco there? Please. Is there anybody here from the Town of East Haven? I entertain a motion to withdraw.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this was withdrawn and dismissed. I move adoption of the House report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fuzeci?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0073, Timothy Herbst and 9-15 Albany Turnpike LLC versus First Selectman, Town of Canton, et al. Is anyone here on that matter?
Mr.
Commissioner Michael Collins from Allen and Sage for the respondents. Although I'm only here to urge the commission about the recommended dismissal.
This is Timothy Herbst. Chairman, please. I'd entertain a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The complainant failed to appear. It was dismissed and admonished for the failure to appear at the hearing on this matter, which resulted in a waste of scarce state and local resources. Without objection from the respondent, I move adoption to the House.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion?
I have a question.
Yes.
Can somebody just confirm me that there is a note, the Timothy Herbst in 915 Albany Turnpike, never after the hearing, never responded, just ignored everything.
To my knowledge, Commissioner Felicia Harmon, for the record, I have not heard from the complainant since this hearing officer's report issued, which was shortly after the hearing where the complainants did not show.
Including, according to our procedures, he would have gotten a notice of this hearing officer.
Yes, it's
afterward. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any further discussion? I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn? Mr. Fuzeschi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you, Attorney Collins. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0120, Paul Mikowski versus Chairman, Board of Education, Town of Darien, et al. Is there anyone here? Is Paul Mikowski there? Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Mahalski,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Are you an attorney, sir?
I am an attorney.
Thank you, counsel. Is there anyone here from the town of Darien?
Yes, Thomas Mooney.
Thank you, Attorney Mooney. All right, we'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0190. Anthony Sirocco versus Chief Police Department, Town of Fairfield, et al. This was a withdrawal. Is Anthony Sirocco there, please? Anyone here from the Town of Fairfield? I'd entertain a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, it was withdrawn and dismissed. I move adoption of the hearing officer.
Second.
Is your discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn? Mr. Fuzeschi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Last on the docket is FIC 2022-0212, Marina DeFlorio versus Chief, Police Department, City of New London, et al. Is Marina DeFlorio there, please? Is anyone here from the City of New London?
Yes, Brian Eastep on behalf of the City of New London.
Attorney Eastep, would you like to be heard?
I'm willing to support the dismissal.
Thank you. I'd entertain a motion. This is a no-show.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is a complaint that failed to appear. It was a dismissal with no objection. The respondent, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, take a roll call. Please say aye. Commissioner Einhorn? Mr. Fuzeschi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan? Yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you. Before we consider the cases, I will ask the Executive Director, Colleen Murphy, to please make the usual announcements.
Sure. As we've indicated, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety, so there's no need to ask us for a recording when your matter comes up, but you can access it on our website soon after the meeting. If you have any issues, just let us know. And second, pursuant to our regulations, oral argument is 10 minutes per side, and I'll keep track of that for the parties.
Thank you. Calling the first matter that's marked ready, docket number FIC 2021-0214, Susan Hay and Associated Press versus Governor. Did I miss it? Oh, excuse me. I apologize. Calling the first matter marked ready is Andre Sosa. Docket number FIC 2020-0404, Andre Sosa versus Commissioner, State of Connecticut, Department of Correction, et al. Are you there, Mr. Sosa?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone here, Attorney McCurdy, still here from the state? Okay, thank you. All right. So, Mr. Sosa, would you like to begin, please?
Yes, I found this on the mail or some email that they are denying me. And the email, they are claiming client, attorney-client privilege. But I'd like to make clear that anything that was saying, or it was being saying in those emails, it is in regard to myself. So.
Is there anything further, Mr. Sosa?
No, it was just about pending litigation that had to do with me in regard of finding stuff in court. So I don't understand why it is such a big deal. So I asked for an in-camera review as well.
Okay. Thank you, Attorney McCurdy.
Thank you. First off, it's nice to see you all in person. I'll be brief. I urge adoption of the hearing officer's report. The sole record at issue is one email. There was testimony. It was redacted based on attorney-client privilege, as he said. It was a two-line email. It's clearly marked from Assistant Attorney General Neil Perill to DOC staff. At the hearing officer's request, the respondent provided an affidavit from Attorney General Perill saying he was providing legal advice in response to a request. In addition, the hearing officer did do an in-camera review and concluded that it was relating to legal advice and was made in confidence. Such communications are covered by the attorney-client privilege, and therefore the email is not subject to disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. The respondent's actions were proper, and therefore the complaint should be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sosa, did you hear that? Okay. There was an in-camera review, and it was determined that the attorney-client privilege applied.
Yeah, they always say that.
Okay. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think that should apply there because, you know, I'm the third-party beneficiary. I'm the one that's being talked about on those emails. That's all really I can say, you know, it ain't much. Plus, I don't think it was only just legal advice that was being said in there.
A neutral did review it and determined that it was privileged information. So.
All right.
Any further discussion by any of the
commissioners? Just one quick question. He seems to think it was shared with a third party. It wasn't shared with a party. The email was between two parties for attorney-client privilege.
I think he said that he was the third party beneficiary. So.
Oh, I thought that he.
That was my take on it.
I thought that's what he was saying, but it was from AAG Perill to a DOC staff member and a CMHC staff member who was contracted for medical care for DOC. So
I just wanted to affirm that for the complainant to let him know that it wasn't shared with him, it was shared with appropriate people between clients and attorneys.
Okay.
Great.
And nothing further.
Anything further? I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Mr. Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Giuseppe?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Sosa. Thank you, Attorney McCurdy.
All right. That was
Susan. No, we're done. Yeah. Okay, so next is calling docket number FIC 2021-0214, Susan Hay and Associated Press versus Governor, State of Connecticut, Office of the Governor et al. Are you an attorney?
No, I'm a reporter.
Okay. You address you appropriately, that's all. But it doesn't look like you have any opponents, so.
They admitted that they were in the wrong.
All right. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Susan Haig. I'm a state house and a political writer for the Associated Press. It's a position I've had for the last 20 years. And honestly, this is my first complaint I've ever filed in my career. Thank you for considering my complaint today. It's regarding documents that I requested on May 21st, 2020, for a National Associated Press story about outside influences on the COVID reopening process. As you can see from the hearing officer's accurate report, representatives of Governor Ned Lamont's office acknowledged during the September 16th hearing that they did fail to promptly disclose the documents I requested, that I had to wait 2 years for. They testified about being short-staffed and how they faced unprecedented challenges because of the pandemic, which I understood. They also pointed out that they've taken some steps to try to remedy the situation, and they did provide me with thousands of documents. But I feel, while this is all true, it's very important that you are aware of a few things. I mean, first of all, even though I did receive thousands of documents, I didn't get them until after the story ran, like, you know, months after the story ran, a year and a half pretty much. Many did not pertain to my original request, and more than 2 years later, as you can imagine, they have very little relevance right now to in a sort of a kind of a post-pandemic world. Second, the governor's office made the argument that they were short-staffed, and like I said, they had challenges during COVID, which you'll notice during the hearing. I did acknowledge this, and I was trying to be very patient throughout this process. But I want you to know that at least one other news organization did get documents during this, and that's what sparked my complaint to you. I mean, this should not be happening, that someone can just jump the line like that. Also, they were able to get text messages. I can tell you, as a reporter in the press corps, it is so difficult to get text messages from anybody in state government. I don't know what you can do about it, but I only received a handful, and I didn't get any from key members of the administration, including Josh Jabal, who was the chief operating officer who dealt with the reopening committee. And fourth, you know, it was disclosed during the hearings that my documents were actually ready in January. That came to a surprise, as a surprise to me, and I did not get them until June. I understand that there was a change of staff, but again, this should not be happening. It really should not. And, you know, as I said, a lot of this is old news by now. It is, you know, a lot of these things really aren't newsworthy, but, you know, and I don't believe that the unacceptably long waiting period was any malice against me or the AP, but I do feel that this system is broken, and it really needs to work better for journalists. We shouldn't have, and for the public for that matter, we shouldn't have to wait 2 years to get documents, pandemic or no pandemic. And again, I stress that I was willing to work with them to narrow the scope, and I should note this was a national story. The same FOI request was sent to all state governors around the country. The names were different. And Connecticut was one of a handful, I think three, that never responded. And ultimately, Connecticut was not part of the final story. And it's unfortunate because I did come across things in the documents that probably would have worked out for that story, that there were some outside influences. So I just came here today to explain that I really think there needs to be a better system. It's frustrating to get a dump of a bunch of documents and emails that really didn't pertain to my original request. They come, you know, years late and in really no order. And I don't know what you can do. I understand that the governor's office has new staff. The person that I dealt with is no longer working there. And I understand and I believe that the new legal counsel is making steps, but I just want you to kind of hold their feet to the fire somehow. And just know that it's, you know, we report for the readers. We're here getting information, you know, for state residents. They want to know who's influencing the decision to reopen after COVID. And this is important stuff. And I didn't want to just let it go. I know that the hearing officer found that they were in violation, but I felt that you should be aware of what I went through. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
I just think it's lamentable in paragraph 17 that we were one of three states, which means if my math is correct, 27 other states have did comply.
They did. They so, responded to the FOI.
Batting average. So yeah, I don't know if I should apologize on Connecticut's behalf, but it's lamentable.
I don't know if you have any power to do anything to make sure that this doesn't happen again. I don't know. I don't know what ability you have.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing is, you know, if another case comes before us that has to do with the governor's office on a similar case, then at some point we'll probably consider civil penalties or something. But at this point, you know, this seems to be the first. But echoing my, you know, Commissioner Hankins, I mean, the fact that the Hartford Courant was able to get this information in a much more timely manner, you know, there should be a level playing field, especially if you asked for it first, you should have received it.
Can you describe what information did they get that you didn't get? Was it all the information?
It was pandemic related, but it didn't pertain to my request. My request primarily was communications regarding the reopening committee. And then they had a story that dealt with COVID. I honestly don't remember exactly what it was, but it had to do with, it included emails and text messages. I don't know how it happened, but they definitely skipped the line. And that's what prompted me to reach out and file a complaint. But it was along the same lines. I mean, you're talking about the same people. You know, there's only a handful of people that are dealing with this stuff. And I don't understand how they were able to get something so quickly, and I had to wait 2 years. And I had already waited, it had already been like over a year at that point, and I was livid, to be honest.
And you had to wait a long time for a hearing before us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. But I won't get into that. I understand.
I understand. Yeah. I don't know if there's anything we can do.
No, I mean, I think the governor's office has had some training on FOI. The lieutenant governor's office recently did, and I did a presentation, but it was quite a while ago now. So, you know, that's something we could consider.
You could also make a story out of this.
It's true.
Well,
take a look at the news industries.
So you're suggesting maybe amending the decision to add training?
Well, I think that would be the only option at this juncture. I believe the governor's office has obtained some sort of tracking system and sort of independent of this case that they have been working on faster response, but I don't know the specifics of it or how well it's working.
That's a good suggestion. I'd entertain a motion with regard to that, suggesting that there should be some training. I don't think anybody would object to training.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion that we add a second bullet to the order, instructing them to, and I don't know how who we would be instructing, but I would say if it's governor staff, to I'm looking to Colleen for that.
Yeah.
To receive some sort of, to contact the Freedom of Information Commission for direction on how to get training.
Right. I would just.
Unless you have better language.
Generally that's what we do with, something like within a certain time period, the respondent's office shall reach out to the commission to schedule a workshop for members of the respondent staff.
That's fine. Well,
okay. Second.
Motion made and seconded. Is there discussion on the amendment? I just have one question. Will Tom Hennick be able to teach this class?
Probably, but governors? we have some other qualified folks who could step in if
I'm sure we do.
If he can't do this one, but
Tom's a legend. All right. So any other further discussion?
I don't think I set a time period. Do you want to set a time period within a time period for them to reach out?
As I was joking, I was just earlier, but we probably should wait till after the election. I assume so, if we give them some time, because they'll probably be busy in the next month.
Okay.
So I don't know if we want to say 60 days,
90
days, I don't know.
Yeah, I would say at least 90 days.
Yeah.
Do you think that's too long, Colin?
Well, I think they can reach out sooner
okay,
to
okay.
schedule it.
Okay.
They reach out within 40 days, for maybe 14 days, and for a workshop to be conducted within 90 days.
90 days thereafter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Would you, you might
amend yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll withdraw the first amendment.
Move on a second.
And I'll give the second amendment with the same language, putting the phraseology for the timelines as well.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none.
I would note that in paragraph 18 of the, and in your comments, it's going to go the way that there's a lot of new staff at the governor's office to make possible more responsive. And the new staff and more focused, at least that's able to focus, so I think, with the new staff, particularly. Okay, and you're good to have training.
I agree.
Hopefully they stick to it.
I think that they would welcome training. I think it would be a good thing for them. So then with regard to the amendment, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fisashi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And Owen Egan, yes.
Mr. Chairman,
passes unanimously.
I will move the head of your officer's report.
The motion to.
Oh, second.
Is there discussion with regard to the hearing officer's report as amended? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor of the hearing officer's report as amended. Mr. Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fisashi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. So it passes unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
Next is docket number FIC 2021-0411, Anthony Price versus Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer, Connecticut Innovations et al.
Yes, I call your name.
Yeah. So we have Anthony Price and we have Attorney Christopher Cagle.
Yes.
Mr. Price, would you like to begin?
Yes. As a woman before me announced, this is actually my first time filing a complaint. I'm a citizen of Connecticut. My expertise is economic development. I'm an entrepreneur. I've started three businesses, as well as I'm a writer. I'm a published author, and I write. And this is the reason why I'm here today is because I've begun writing a story on this issue. The original complaint was filed back on December 1st, 2020 with Connecticut Innovations, and that sort of got the ball, rolling. A couple things. I will mention that I have two primary issues with this document that was written by staff. I'm not sure if I see the gentleman who wrote this document. It's listed as Christopher Jenkins. Okay, there he is. I didn't recognize him. So he wrote this document. So I have some issues specifically with this document. The first is that it doesn't address specifically what I asked. So one of the things that I asked, there's two issues that this is addressing. The first issue is the valuation spreadsheet that it goes into very detail about, okay? The second issue that was not even mentioned was I wanted information on the return on investment of the taxpayers' money. Nowhere is that mentioned in here. I requested information for 10 years of information. So Connecticut Innovations takes taxpayer money without our consent and invests it. And they do not want to provide any information on the returns on those investments. And what they've decided to do is come up with this thing called the valuation sheet and basically put an iron curtain around any information I want. So
There's been a number of situations where Connecticut Innovations has cashed out of an investment. They're no longer involved in it, or they may have a small investment in it, and some of these companies have went public, and they do not want to tell the public what is the return on investment. Most venture capital firms do not make money. If they do 10 deals, probably 9 will fail and 1 will be a big winner. They do not want to provide this information. As a citizen of the state of Connecticut, I find it appalling that anyone would write this type of document and not even address that primary concern of when are they going to tell the public what is the return on investment, not in aggregate, but on each investment that they've invested in. When are they going to tell the public, we invested $1 million in this company, it cashed out 8 years ago, what's the return on investment? Now, this is a very important issue because generally, historically, venture capital firms, which is what Connecticut Innovations wants to call themselves, they have done a terrible job supporting people of color. And it's like that. It's a frat boy type of mentality. And that's sort of the mantra or the way that they've acted towards this request. So that's really this document doesn't address that primary concern of what about the investments Connecticut Innovation has cashed out? When are we going to find out what is the return on investment? So I don't know how we're going to address that, but that's not addressed in here. Is there any
further?
No, so that's the first part. That hasn't been addressed. And if you look at this document, there's a number of issues that I have with this particular document. What they're saying is this valuation sheet, which I think they're putting everything in the kitchen sink on this sheet and saying it's a trade secret. It's ridiculous. So they're creating an iron curtain. And this problem is a huge problem because on my last search, we have 15 quasi-public entities in the state of Connecticut. So they're all creating this curtain saying, well, you can't do this. It's a trade secret. So anyways, there's a number of things. On line item 21, chief operating officer, chief financial officer known as Philip Sayuda, mentioned that they invest in privately held companies that are otherwise unable to attain conventional financing. So they're investing in companies that would not receive financing. So this argument that if we don't keep everything secret, we're going to go somewhere else. There is nowhere else for them to go. There is nowhere else to go. And the majority of these companies are going to fail. And I will say this, the 10 years I wanted, that goes through different, it goes through, you know, the current governor's administration. It goes through Malloy's administration. If I went further, it would go to everyone, the other administrations. I can tell you this, no one in the state capitol can tell you what return on investment we got for a specific investment. So the General Assembly has failed us, and I'm hoping that you do not fail the public because no one knows what the return on any of these investments are, and we keep giving them money. In fact, I know they're getting over $100 million or should be getting over $100 million recently, and we have no way of telling what the return is. So that's one of the issues that I mentioned. And so I don't even really want to spend my time arguing about what they call this valuation sheet. I want to know, what about all the other investments that they've made? What is the return on the investments? And when do they plan to tell the public? Now, Connecticut Innovations, Matt McCooey goes all over the country, Israel, all over the world, saying they're a venture capital firm. The way a venture capital firm works is it takes investments from its general partners. The general partners in Connecticut Innovations are the taxpayers. Why aren't we being told what's going on? And that's the problem right now. We are the general partners of Connecticut Innovations. And Matt McCooey and everyone else will say they're a venture capital firm. That's how it works. In terms of this document, the spreadsheet, as I said, it's a big issue. I'm going to have to probably, you know, come back again regarding that. But I want to spend my time talking about, why can't we get the return on investments that Connecticut Innovations has cashed out? Even if they still have money in it, some of these companies are public. So I can get all that information. I get any information from that publicly traded company. Their Q4, their 10-4, their 10-K reports, and all the other documents. And the other thing, too, I want to mention is that the public is significantly disadvantaged by this process. I will mention that the attorneys, just for the record, the attorneys who basically file legal appearances here also include Matthew Ritter, who is the speaker in the state of Connecticut, the Speaker of the House, Matthew Ritter, Josette Cass, who also was who's on record here filing. She was at one point part of the Connecticut Supreme Court, and she also was an appellate judge.
So, I mean, we have all this firepower. This firm has 140 attorneys going against me. I'm not trained in law. I'm a citizen who wants to write a story and find out, are we getting a return on investment? And this is just very disappointing that this doesn't mention any of that. It hides behind all this other legalese that doesn't mean anything to me. Can we get a return on the, can I get the information on the return on investment so I can write a story? And I will mention that we've had so much fraud in the state. We've had a governor go to jail. We've had a treasurer go to jail. We've had current people in the General Assembly that have gone to jail. We need to know that something illegal is not going on. And the only way that you, the only disinfectant right now is to put light on this and to publish this information. And without your help, I cannot do my job. I can't let the taxpayers know, you know, I don't have the information to tell them whether this Connecticut Innovations is generating a fair return for our money that we're putting in it, that we have no control over. So that's really my main issue. I know that January 6th, 2021, you know, a lot of people said that's the death of democracy. No, the death of democracy is when we can't get information on our own government, and people stand up and say that's the way it should be. That's when democracy dies. So before January 6, 2021, these are all the paper cuts that are killing us. We need to have access to the information. We need to do stories on it. Without it, I don't know what's going to happen. And I will mention this. This document that they said, the spreadsheet, no one has access to it. So how do we know what's going on? I wanted to specifically know, does Governor Lamont have access to this document? Does David LeMahon, who's in charge of economic development in the state. I want to know, does Sean Wooden, the state treasurer, does he have access to this? He's on the board. Does Matt Ritter have access to this document? He's also, as an attorney, does he have access to this information? Does Ann Lamont, who's a very well-known venture capitalist, who's the husband of the governor, does she have access to this information? I know she's been involved with Connecticut Innovations. Who has access to this information? And when are we going to share it to the with the taxpayers to let us know, are we getting a fair return on our investment? That's specifically the reason why I'm here. And we're almost in 2 years of this matter. It's almost 2 years, and I don't care if pandemic or not. If it wasn't a pandemic, it'd be some other excuse to getting answers. So this is why I'm here. I'm really fired up about it because it just doesn't make any sense. Let's see if that's 10 minutes, but let me just see if I have any questions. And then where's the oversight? Where's the General Assembly? What are they getting reports on this information on a regular basis? It just boggles my mind that this is acceptable, that more and more government is going behind a black curtain and we have to spend 2 years to come here just to get some basic information. It's just appalling. But yet Connecticut Innovations is a ward of the state. They need money from us, but yet they don't want to tell us what the return on their investment is. I mean, that's a sad commentary where we can give money to someone and they can say, it's trade secret. We don't have to tell you. And I bet, man, Cooey, the CEO of Connecticut Innovations, quoted an article saying, I can't tell you the return. We had such a great return on an investment, we named a room after someone. But I can't tell you how much of a return we got on that investment. So that's public. He said that in the newspaper. He said it on video. And when are we going to get a return? I can also say, I'm going to request their information on salaries. Every single one of the people on the investment committee probably makes more than department heads in the state of Connecticut. That's what we're doing. We're paying all these people all this money to tell us nothing, but it's okay for them to take our money. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Cahill, Shipman and Goodwin, on behalf of the respondents, Connecticut Innovations, its COO, CFO, Bill Sayuda. This decision, the proposed decision, from our point of view, is well-supported, well-reasoned, and correct. Connecticut Innovation's mission, which is a statutory mission, is to provide invest in private companies for the purpose of growing the economy. The complainant, Mr. Price, requested numerous documents initially, all of which were provided, and the issue got boiled down to the information on this spreadsheet, which reports gains and losses for each individual investment, not in the aggregate, but for each one. And the respondents claimed that that was a trade secret, that was exempt from disclosure. So that's the sole issue in this proceeding. And to decide whether something's a trade secret, there's two prongs. The law's very clear, whether it derives independent economic value from its secrecy. And the decision addresses that squarely in paragraph 27 and 28, where Mr. Sayuda's testimony is credited that companies wouldn't provide information to Connecticut Innovations to perform the statutory mission if that information is then shared publicly through the valuations that are on the spreadsheet. And then secondly, the second prong is whether the information is subject to efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain the secrecy. And that would be in paragraphs 25, 29, and 30 of the proposed decision, where, again, Mr. Sayuda's testimony is credited, and he explains some of the steps that Connecticut Innovations takes to keep the information confidential. So, just focusing squarely on the issue about whether or not the information on the spreadsheet is a trade secret, I think the proposed decision gets it right. And again, it's well supported with facts. It's well reasoned on the law. And overall, it's correct and should be adopted. Thank you.
So what he's saying is, as the attorney is saying, that wasn't the only issue. That's what someone decided to put on the document saying that's the only issue. I'm specifically saying here today, we should have information on all the other investments that Connecticut Innovation has made and exited. What is the amount of money that was put into those companies, and what's the return on investment? If they're going to say they're a venture capital firm, that's the way it works. You share what your return on investment is with the general partners. The general partners are the state of Connecticut. And I will mention that if you look at Sean Wooten at the state of Connecticut, the treasurer's office, they used to report on a quarterly basis what the returns on investments are on a regular basis. I'm asking for Connecticut Innovations to say, you picked these investments, you thought that these were gonna be good investments, what's the return on investments? We need to know that. Without that, government does not work. It does not work. No one knows this. And I can say this with confidence. I don't know if anyone has ever, if they've ever shared that information with the state of Connecticut. So what's the General Assembly doing? I'm trying to figure out who is responsible for this. Who's the oversight party? Who's going to step up for the taxpayers? Who's going to step up and say, okay, this is not right? Now, I know the other side has all these high-priced attorneys, but it's just ridiculous. And I've had this, all of us had to come here today. This is a beautiful day. I'd rather be outside doing something.
Council?
No further response other than just emphasize what I said previously.
Yes, I'll try to be as brief as I can. The trade secret exemptions, prong one and prong two were met. Set them forth. The non-exhaustive list stated in the Helm City Cheese and in the preamble. The beginning part of section 1-210B5A, the non-exhaustive list, is like the non-exhaustive list and is analogous to that, which was determined a key sheet in Alcoa Renewable Energy. And the trade secret, the spreadsheet, is closely analogous to the key answers. So it does encompass what everyone's saying. And I think Mr. Price argues eloquently. I'd like to read his book. I think the argument of Mr. Price, I think it's well taken, but I think it's beyond the scope of the statute. I think Mr. Price has outpaced the statute. And if it needs to be changed, so be it. But we can't, as a commission, go beyond our statutory powers. And I understand what you're saying, Mr. Price. I really do. But we have to go according to the law. And according to the law, I guess that's a dramatic thing. We go according to the law. And the law says that it's a trade secret and therefore exempt.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes, I think that the hearing officer did what he needed to do here, which was to follow where the FOI jurisdiction was and the law. Mr. Price, I applaud your passion, and I would like to know this information too. But currently, the way it is with the FOI and the test for a public trade secret, it looks like that information isn't available. But I urge you that, you know, laws can be changed. If you take this to the General Assembly and ask them these questions, maybe they don't know. Maybe they'd be interested. And they could change the law or change how we view trade secrets. Because, you know, you ask some, you know, interesting questions. And again, I applaud your passion. But I think it, in this case, the hearing officer got it right. He ran the test for the two prongs. And it would, you know, it would be a trade secret. I'm saddened for the public that, you know, sometimes some the sunshine doesn't get in there. That's what we should be representing. Our symbol is the sun. So hopefully, you know, things may change. Another administration may change. The laws may change. So at some point, maybe this information will become.
Mr. Price, if I may, I remember in an economics class that I took. They said that a genius is not known for being right, but being wrong for very subtle reasons. And you have very subtle reasons here, okay? And I join with Commissioner Schroeder in, you know, that maybe it's time for a change with the trade secrets. But today is not the day.
Okay. So what I'm saying is there are companies that Connecticut Innovations no longer has investments in, may not even be on that sheet. So how is that? How is that a trade secret? If they made an investment in something 10 years ago or 5 years ago and cashed out and have no they have no money in it, how is that a trade secret? Like, why can't they tell the public this is the return on investment? That doesn't fall into this little basin or cup or whatever, you know, area that you've described. These are investments that are they're no longer in.
I hate to argue by analogy because I'm always wrong, okay? But it's sort of like attorney-client privilege. If something is exempt because of attorney-client privilege, after the case is over, you can say, well, the privilege no longer exists, but yet it does. Okay? So it's like that when they cashed out or whatever. It was a trade secret then. It's still a trade secret. That's the best I can answer for you. And it's probably faulty logic, but I'm known for that. That's one of my strengths.
It makes sense that you want that information, and I think that's what everyone here is saying. It makes sense that you want that information. The public should be entitled to that information, but at this point, Attorney Hankins has applied the law appropriately, and the law says you can't get it.
We can't get it. The public can't get it.
We can't get it. Correct.
But they can get our money. Got it.
That doesn't mean I think what Commissioner Streeter said was accurate. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and change the law, because that's something that should be looked at. Commissioner Kazeshi?
I am not very accepted. Many of us are very committed to the state doing as much as it can to help new businesses get started in our state and innovate. And it's a complex question how to do that most effectively and best. I'm glad you're focusing on that question. For today's purposes, I think the legal decision, the parameters of what we can do are defined. And so, but you're bringing focus to the issue of what can Connecticut do and how can it do it best to support new young companies get started and get going is an important question. And I hope a lot of people continue to think about it. And I hope you continue to focus on it. But unfortunately, right now, for this moment, we can only do what is appropriate under the legal parameters. And I hope you continue to bring the issue of how to innovate, how to support innovation, and what are the business parameters and confidentiality parameters around that best serve that long-term goal of bringing state funding and support to innovation, to assisting younger companies and younger venture entities.
Anyone else? Council?
I have no further statements.
Thank you. Sir?
Yeah, I'll just say that the public is being let down. This is not about innovation. It's about transparency.
We can debate what's the right company to invest in. This is simply transparency. You got so much money, you're a ward of the state, you need the public money, but yet you don't want to tell us what your returns are. So just, so basically what Connecticut Innovations is saying, shut up and give me your money. I don't have to tell you anything. No further comment. Thank you.
I think what Commissioner Fusashi is saying, there's a balancing here of trying to help young companies and help them develop here in Connecticut versus the public's right to know what's happening with their money. And that's what you're indicating for is the public needs to know that. And I'm sure the legislature has looked at that when they created the law, but it doesn't mean that they can't look at it again. Right? And it's wonderful that you're bringing focus to this. So we all encourage you to continue to do that, both here and with the legislature. I mean, it's something that they have to discuss, and better minds than mine will work on it. So, with that, unless there's anything further, I'd entertain a
Mr. Chairman, motion. I'll move adoption of the hearing officer.
Second motion.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fusashi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate
Price.
Your
Thank
arguments.
You,
thank you.
Calling docket number FIC 2021-0610, Matthew Hennessy versus Donald Stein, Chair, Materials Innovation and Recycling Authority et al. Counsel, identify themselves, please.
Craig Dickinson from Fort Harrison for the complainant, Matthew Hennessy.
And Michael Collins from Haller & Sage for the respondents.
Thank you. He was most aggrieved.
Materials innovation.
Yes. Materials innovation. Attorney Collins.
I'm sorry.
Attorney Collins.
Thank you, sir. I'm not here to contest the proposed final decision. In fact, the respondents urged the board to adopt the decision of the proposed decision from the hearing officer. Primarily, I'd like to address some of the arguments that have been made by the complainant in a post decision submission to the commission. First, and I think most significantly, complainants. Argument begins by saying, despite having been repeatedly ordered to strictly comply with provisions of the Freedom of Information Act, the evidence showed that the respondents continued to violate the act. And then the complainant goes on to cite several decisions of the commission. Three of those decisions were decided this year. The complaint here dates back to October of 2021, and the meeting about which the complaint raises issues was in September of 2021. Obviously, MIRA did not have the benefit of those commission decisions when this issue came up. The claimant also argued that the respondents conceded that the description in the executive session at issue did not inform the public of the specific RFPs. That's simply not true. As the hearing officer found, the notice stated that there were going to be RFPs that discussed Connecticut solid waste system transfer facilities, transportation and disposal of acceptable solid waste at alternate disposal facilities, and the operation of the MIRA's jets. And the record supports that is what was discussed in the executive session. The complainant argued during the hearing that more information might have been helpful. That may be true. However, the title of the RFPs was very generic,
simply the language that I just cited. There are numbers that are associated with each of them, but what the record demonstrated was the only RFPs that were outstanding at the time that this meeting took place were the RFPs that are described here. The hearing officer found that this description was sufficient. I urge the commission to adopt that finding. There was no budgetary discussion in executive session. There was testimony in the record that every decision that MIRA makes with regard to RFPs obviously impacts the budget. And there was discussion of that fact, but there was no budgetary discussion. Frankly, that argument was just misplaced by the complainant in this matter. The only violation that was found by the hearing officer is that the CEO did not certify, pursuant to statute, that the benefit of withholding the information outweighed the benefit of the public getting the information with regard to the RFPs. And with the exception of one of the RFPs, that is conceded. Up until one of the decisions that I mentioned happened earlier this year, the MIRA was under the mistaken belief that portion of the statute that requires certification only applied to requests for documents, that it didn't apply to executive session. That interpretation was wrong. We acknowledge that it was wrong. However, at the time that the executive session took place, again, didn't have the benefit of the commission decision that made that clear. Just in conclusion, we again submit that the hearing officer's analysis was well thought out and well supported by the record, and we urge the commission to adopt it.
Thank you. Commissioners, as you might imagine, we take great exception to the position that's espoused by MIRA and the suggestion that we didn't know any better. These are all very experienced people that have been before in acting on behalf of public agencies for years, if not decades. They have all had to deal with executive sessions on a daily, on a regular basis. They've all been trained in this. In fact, as was previously described, the legendary Tom Hennick provided training to this self-same group. So the pleas of ignorance and inability to comply because they didn't know better should not be credited. Enough already. We have a litany of decisions in the hearing officer's report alone that set forth the number of violations that they've had. This strikes me as very much like the person that has a glove box full of violations, and they don't care because nothing happens. So I'm going to talk about the different violations that we think need to be amended and addressed in the opinion, and then finish by talking about the fact that it's about time that maybe you should exercise your ability to impose a penalty on this entity. to begin with, the suggestion in the hearing officer's report that the issue about the clarity or the specificity of the agenda item and the announcement before they went into executive session was not adequately addressed in the complaint is plainly wrong. The first paragraph of the complaint addresses that, explicitly raises it. The only thing it doesn't do is cite the statute, and I don't believe that that's required here. It's usually not required in any type of a civilian type of complaint. It's brought by a lay person. So to suggest that it's not adequately addressed or raised there states the issue. It gives them a pass on something that they shouldn't get. And when it says specifically that reusing boilerplate language from previous agendas, it couldn't be more explicit in terms of what the complaint is about. But the hearing officer decides to sidestep it and not address that. And that's a concern. And as Mr. Collins says here already this morning, they knew the RFP numbers. At the very least, they could have included the RFP numbers. And to suggest that they didn't know what they were going to talk about before the session is frankly bunk. They made arrangements for people for DEEP to be there to talk. They knew what they were going to talk about. They knew exactly what was going to be talked about.
So there's no reason why they shouldn't have included a higher degree of specificity in the agenda item and the announcement before they went into executive session. But they don't. They use the same generic description in all their agendas for month on end and at meetings repeatedly.
Why?
Because nobody holds them to account. Nobody makes them provide the specificity that they should provide. So for that reason, we are urging the commission to direct that the hearing officer's report be amended to include a violation for failure to include adequate specificity in the agenda items in the announcement before they go into executive session, which are clearly reflected in the videos and the meeting minutes. They keep doing it. Nobody holds them to account. And until we hold them to account, they're just going to keep doing it. And it's non-compliant, so they shouldn't be allowed to keep doing it, whether it's a technical violation or not technically set forth adequately in the complaint. It just doesn't hold true. It's raising the complaint. It should be addressed in the decision. We're not going to disagree with Mr. Collins on the fact that the violations were found about the failure to properly certify, because it's clear they didn't certify what they needed to certify. It's reflected in the record. They don't dispute it. They didn't provide the adequate certification. And again, the suggestion that, well, you know, we didn't know that it was clear at the time that it was issued is why we didn't enter the certification. They've been doing this for years. They are constantly skirting on the edge of proceeding in private, in secret. That is their MO. They keep doing it, and they're going to keep doing it unless and until they're called to account, which is why I disagree, and we feel that an amendment is appropriate for the hearing order, the hearing officer's decision with respect to the discussion of the budget. They have advocated, and the hearing officer has adopted a position that if the budget comes up in the context of the RFPs, that's okay. In other words, the exception can swallow the rule. What should be happening is if there's anything that's going to be talked about impact on budget, it should be done in private. And to the extent that it addresses the limited scope of the limited exceptions under the law, then they go into executive session. They don't just say, okay, we have justification to go into an executive session, and then use that as an excuse to cover anything that they want to, including budget material that's explicitly accepted. They're not supposed to discuss that when they're in executive session, unless it's very narrowly tailored. It's not clear that that's the case. Again, the exception is swallowing the rule, and that should not be permitted. The hearing officer's decision should be a change to address that. At the very least, the hearing officer's decision should be amended to set forth more fully why they feel that where the lines are, because we don't have enough of a record to address in subsequent proceedings to get appellate guidance on this. If we're going to bring this up and we're going to get it addressed, we need to know what the thought process was as to where it was. They ignore it. They just say we're not going to address it any further. We're asking that at the very least, if they're not going to find a violation, they more fully articulate the reason for their finding that the budget discussions were not problematic. Same thing with respect to the DEEP officials being there. It's the exception swallowing the rule once again. Because they have the capacity to consult with the DEP bill as experts to see whether specific provisions in RFP proposals are compliant with the permitting process and the statutes, that's acceptable. But that's not what appears to have happened here, because the decision goes on to say that they talked about what modifications of RFPs may be necessary to ensure compliance. That should not be done in private. The people that the public should know where the RFPs are non-compliant, what needs to be done to make them compliant, and to give, frankly, other people that are interested in pursuing the proposals some insight as to what the changes are that need to be made so that they're better educated in terms of making subsequent proposals. But here they're just, you know, once the RFP is implicated, any discussion that's done with the DEP bill is covered by this exception, and the exception is swallowing the rule. That is not the way it should proceed. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. The standard should be to be done in public, and only limited discussions should be done in private in the executive sessions. And what is happening here is the inverse. They use an excuse to go into executive session and then everything gets sucked into that. And that's not the way it should be done, and it shouldn't be countenanced by the commission. So it's our position that the hearing officer's report should be amended to find a violation on that front. Finally, we think the most egregious failure of the in this report is the failure to impose any kind of civil penalty whatsoever. Now, we asked for $1,000, which is the limit per violation. We got none. I sat here earlier today and I heard discussion about the state's failure to turn over material for 2 years and whether, you know, training would illuminate that. Some discussion about, well, you know, they were able to provide material to the Hartford Courant on a timely basis, but they weren't able to do it for AP. How do we address that issue? Right. Let's train them. Yep. Sorry.
He fell off his chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's kind of just an interesting interruption. The Shall I continue?
I feel like I'm listening in on something I shouldn't.
Okay.
Attorney Einhorn.
Yes.
Can you mute your phone, please?
Sorry.
Thank you. It's okay. And you struggled with what you can do about it. In that instance, you said maybe we should have training, and that's when the legendary Tom Hennick came up. The legendary Tom Hennick's already done his job here. It didn't take. They've been given repeated warnings to straighten up and fly right. I think somebody, Mr. Hankins, you used a baseball analogy earlier. This is the fourth strike. How many warnings do you get before you get imposed a violation? I know of no other civil enforcement entity that is so reluctant to exercise its power. The IRS certainly automatically imposes penalties in interest. Code enforcement, you violate, you get the ticket right away. I'm sure if Chairman Stein, in his capacity as the first selectman of Barkhamsted, had a complaint about a noise violation and there was a warning issued the first time and the neighbors called in the second time, he'd expect a penalty to be or summons to be imposed the second violation. How many times does a kid do 60 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone? Does he get a written warning? Probably not more than once. This is the fourth strike. You have the capacity to impose civil penalties. They are not respecting it. There's talk about there being a reasonable, what's the advice of counsel, is fig leaf that they use. Advice of counsel. She's trained. She's experienced. She's their attorney. This is an integral part of what they do. But she keeps telling them that they can do whatever they want. There has to be some consequences if you're going to change the behavior. This is not reasonable grounds for their behavior. To the contrary, this is a pattern. There's an old saying, once is an accident, twice is a coincidence, three times a pattern. We're at four now. It's no longer reasonable grounds to make the mistake. This is deliberate indifference. And if you're going to correct it, you have to impose a penalty. That's it.
7 minutes.
Thank you very much for your indulgence.
I'd love to talk. Mr. Chairman, based on the draft that was here, when this was filed in October 2021, there was only one outstanding. They have to go back to 2012 that they list in their own brief. So basically these three that we had did in the last 3.5 months, to count these as four strikes, I think they're all in the same... It's all in the same ballpark. I think that counsel is correct that they have not had a chance to respond to any of these. So to all of a sudden start heaping a bunch of strikes, it's like continuing to pitch after the game is over. I think that the hearing officer is correct. I don't think that, you know, there is a need for a civil penalty. There are other agencies that get several, you know, cracks at the bat. But like you said, well, this is four in the last 4 months, but these all happened, you know, after all these were decided after this was found. And maybe there's a lot of different similar points on these cases. So I say, you know, we'll give them a chance. But if they have another five or six coming down the pike at that point, then we could take some bites at the apple. But, you know, basically say just because we've had a few in a few months that we're going to start counting all these up. When this occurred, there was only the one. So if I look at their own draft response, yeah, they were only listing one, FIC 2012-650, as the only case that, you know, for consideration for a civil penalty. So I'd be opposed to the civil penalty.
Thank you.
Do you want to hear from Attorney
Hyde? Yes, I would. I didn't know if anybody. Attorney Hyde.
Any questions?
I just wondered if you wanted to comment.
Want to comment on any of the arguments that were made by counsel?
Sure. I guess the first thing is the conflating between what was in the complaint and what is being argued now with respect to. You know, what was in the notice or what was in the agenda. And the complaint says that, or alleges, that the respondents failed to state the specific reason for going into executive session. And it is a different allegation than saying that the agenda failed to provide the public with notice of the business to be transacted. So that's why in paragraph 8, I don't talk about that allegation because that was not in the complaint. And there's a much lower threshold for stating a reason to go into executive session, which I believed that the notice was provided. So that's that, in my opinion. The certification of public interest and confidentiality, I think, was addressed already. They conceded that they did not make that certification with respect to three of the RFPs, and they did credibly testify that they made that certification with respect to one RFP. That was especially credible because they conceded that they did not do it for the other three. So I didn't feel the need to actually take that certification in and look at that. I didn't need to find another violation for the fourth RFP because I'd already found a violation, so I didn't feel the need to find another violation there. Lastly, I would just say that if you do look at the second order of the hearing officer report, it specifically says that the commission's not going to allow the respondents to indefinitely rely on attorney on the advice of their attorney as a reasonable basis, which goes directly to whether or not civil penalties might be given in the future. And so I would say that that was not addressed by the complainants, but I did want to put that out there, that that is something that is in the report. That's all I have for you.
Thank you. I just have one question for Attorney
Dickinson.
So, you know, I always find this question of reliance on counsel is a really difficult and important balancing test, because we do want people to rely on the advice of counsel. And so I think that makes this, and I reopened hearing your argument, but general reliance on counsel and encouraging reliance on counsel is, I think, very, very important. And this last sentence here is pretty strong within the parameters of how one shows acknowledgement of counsel might have made perfect judgments and we have to respect it, and that we want to encourage people to rely on counsel. And but it says, in a very diplomatic and clear way, though, that at some point that balancing test may tilt. And I just hope, I would like to hear your counsel yourself, obviously. That balancing test is a difficult one, but I don't think it was ignored here.
I don't think it was ignored, Commissioner, and I join you in your preference to have people listen to their attorneys, because I know how frustrating it is. I frankly had that discussion about a different matter this morning with
parties that weren't listening to counsel. I don't dispute that. The concern that we are advancing here, what we're advocating for, or the concern that we're raising, is using that as a pat excuse, as opposed to it being a really discussion of a complex matter that's nuanced, and there's pretty straightforward rules that needed to be followed here. And our concern is that people just go, my lawyer said I could do it that way, and not exercising independent judgment and or the attorney based on, you know, as we set forth, there's a lot of experience here. People have been doing this for a long time. Counsel's been doing this for a long time. The decision goes back to 2012. Mr. Hennig's training was a year before this meeting took place. So while there are a number of the violations and their timing issues, and I respect the accounting that everybody did with respect to that, there comes a point where there's some concern about the fact that people are doing what they can to dodge their obligations to do things in public, as opposed to making an earnest attempt to be fully compliant. And that's what our concern is, what we're raising. And I do, you know, it is pointed out, we just think that it should go further, that's all.
Yeah, I'm saying it. I think that's a pretty strong sentence. I don't know, I couldn't find better words than at some point, but it's in response to the part of your argument there, but I think it's addressed here about as strongly as at this moment is appropriate, or and articulated expertly. The balance there.
Do any of the other commissioners have anything to say? Do you have anything else to say, counsel?
The only point that I would make is, it's correct that Mr. Hennig had made a presentation to Mira before this. It was at the request of Mira that he come in and do that. And in fact, the record is clear that Mira made some changes as to what they did as far as notice for executive sessions as a result of that training. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure that Mr. Hennig's comments to the board was part of the record here. The specific issue about certification before going into executive session to discuss RFPs was not something that was discussed. Frankly, if it was, we probably would be here.
Anything further?
Nothing further. I've taken up my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, when I spoke, I obviously leave it to the rest of the commissions if they would like to consider civil penalty. I was just getting my thoughts on the record. So for another time, I guess you would like to make that motion and listen to any. Otherwise, I'll move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Mr. Einhorn. Mr. Fuzeshi.
Yeah.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you, Attorney Dickinson. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Can you stand up? Maybe.
Chair. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0120, Palm Mahalski versus Chairman, Board of Education, Town of Marietta, et al. Are you there, Mr. Mahalski?
Hi.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
You are.
Attorney Mahalski.
Better than my mother does.
And Attorney Morgan. All right. So, Attorney Mahalski, would you like to begin?
Thank you, sir. Commissioners, thank you for taking the time to consider this matter. Thanks also for your commitment to open government in Connecticut. There are two questions before you today. First, whether the public can be denied access to a meeting of a public agency being held to discuss potential use of a property just because the use would require filing an application for a standard approval before a zoning commission where there is no pending or threatened litigation. Second, assuming you conclude that such a meeting cannot properly be hidden from the public in an executive session, when does the 30-day clock for appealing denial of access to that meeting begin running? If the meeting does not actually occur at the place specified in the notice and no effort is made to alert the public that it was in fact held at the time specified in the notice. Let me first discuss the substantive denial of access issue because it's a gating question to your consideration of the more procedural appeal clock question. The facts of the denial of access issue are very straightforward. In 2016, the Darien Board of Education filed a routine application for a special permit with the Darien Planning and Zoning Commission to permit it to install and use 80-foot lights on the high school sports stadium. In connection with the application, the Board of Education entered into an agreement with some high school neighbors. The board agreed to include in the application certain specified limitations on lights use and agreed not to file an application seeking more expanded lights use for 5 years. In return, the neighbors agreed not to oppose the application. A special permit was granted with no neighbor opposition in January of 2017. The grant was not contested or appealed, and by law, any right to appeal expired in February of 2017. Upon the expiration of the appeal right with no appeals, the grant became finally adjudicated. The special permit referenced the 5-year agreement, but it did not itself include any limitation on applying for future modifications under the Darien zoning regulations. The 5-year contractual period expired in January of this year, which meant the Darien Board of Education was no longer contractually restricted from filing a new application in the ordinary course under the zoning regulations to modify the special permit, as is the case with all special permits. In January of this year, the Darien Board of Education held a meeting to discuss, quote, whether to file an application with the Darien Planning and Zoning Commission to revise conditions concerning the use of lights, close quote. The meeting was held as an executive session on the basis that it was somehow a discussion, quote, pending litigation. I believe the analysis under FOIA is quite straightforward. There was no pending or threatened litigation. There were no disputes involving the special permit or the contract. There was nothing unusual about the special permit because of the existence of the neighbor contract. The Board of Education's filings in this matter try to characterize the special permit as a temporary order or a pending matter, but that simply isn't true. It's a matter of fact or law. Nothing in the special permit made it temporary or pending. It granted the rights to use the lights indefinitely. It became finally adjudicated as a matter of law. The filing being discussed by the Board of Education was simply a new application pursuant to a zoning regulation and zoning process open to all holders of special permits. Without real pending litigation, the Board of Education meeting was nothing more than a discussion by a public agency about exercising its legal right to use its property in a manner that would require a zoning permit. If that can be cloaked in executive session, then public agencies could hide from the public all discussions regarding use or development of properties if that use would require an application to a planning commission or a regulatory agency. The exception would swallow FOIA. I respectfully ask the commission to declare the Board of Education's meeting to have been an improper executive session and order disclosure of the minutes in any recording or transcript of that meeting. Assuming you agree that holding the meeting as an executive session was an improper denial of public access that must be remedied, then it's necessary to address the procedural issue that was the subject of the hearing officer's recommendation to merely dismiss this complaint. Section 1206 of the Act generally requires appeals to be filed within 30 days of the denial to attend a meeting. There is an exception for a, quote, unnoticed or secret meeting, which starts the 30-day clock from the time the person filing the appeal, quote, receives actual or constructive notice that such meeting was held. Imagine if a public agency noticed a meeting to be held in room 100 at Town Hall. A member of the public shows up, the room is empty. There's no sign saying that the meeting had been moved 2 floors up to room 300. There is no way to say that this person had constructive or actual notice that the meeting was held. What happened in this case is the technological equivalent in our new world of virtual meetings. I showed up at the virtual location in the public notice for someone only interested in viewing, where people were told they should go if they merely wanted to watch the meeting, and there was no meeting there. The key facts relevant to this procedural question are as follows. In January of this year, the board posted a notice of a special meeting to be held on January 25th for the purpose of the executive session on this topic. I saw the notice the day before on January 24th, and I called the commission's offices. I spoke with a member of the staff and then sent an email to the board referencing my conversation and expressing my view that the executive session seemed to be improper. On the same day, the board chairman responded saying that they believed an executive session was permitted because they were discussing a legal right. I replied that this was exactly the issue I had discussed with the staff. I again urged them not to hold an illegal meeting and said I would file a complaint if they did. The public notice for the meeting said there were 3 ways to participate, in person, by Zoom, or on YouTube. The notice said that those wishing to just view the meeting, quote, should watch it on YouTube. On January 25th, I followed the instructions of the notice. I connected to YouTube prior to the 6:30 meeting time. I simply wanted to know if they went forward despite knowing the view of the commission staff. At approximately 6:30, a black screen appeared for approximately 90 seconds. The 90-second recording of the black screen remained on YouTube. There was no indication that a meeting had occurred. Then the regular meeting started at 7:30. It was available at the YouTube link, and there was no mention of a special meeting or an executive session having occurred. I assumed that the board had decided wisely not to hold the executive session. But the next day, I sent an email to the chairman and the school superintendent asking if the executive session had in fact occurred on this topic. I received no response. I continued to check the Board of Education website for minutes of a special meeting. I continued to check YouTube for a video or some explanation. The 90-second black recording remained. On February 23rd, nearly a month later, minutes for the regular meeting were posted, but there were no minutes for any special meeting. This further confirmed my assumption that the executive session had been canceled. To be certain, on February 23rd, I sent another email saying that I was still assuming the executive session had not occurred. Only on February 25th did I receive a response with evidence that the executive session had actually happened. I then filed the complaint with the commission. Although I provided this chronology in the complaint, at the hearing on July 8th, Attorney Mooney, counsel for the board, stated at the beginning of his presentation, and I quote, "The Board of Education is not moving to dismiss on the basis of timeliness, so the 30-day issue is moot from our perspective. As a result, timeliness was not addressed at the hearing or in the party's subsequent written submissions." If there is no evidence of a meeting being held at one of the places that the notice says it will be held, the only reasonable result from the standpoint of open government and protecting the right of the public to appeal under 1-206 is to conclude that the notice became defective and the meeting became unnoticed for the limited purpose of appeal by people who showed up at the non-existent meeting location. The burden must shift to the public agency to put people who showed up there on constructive or actual notice that a meeting was held. It would have been simple for the board to do that. They could have posted a notice on that YouTube page. They could have posted minutes of the special meeting. They could have posted a notice where they post minutes explaining that the meeting occurred. Or they could respond to emails that they received asking if the meeting had occurred. The board did none of this. I did not have constructive or actual notice that the meeting occurred at a different location until February 25th. In fact, with no evidence the meeting was held, the operative language of 1-206, I actually feared that filing an appeal before having actual evidence would risk being a frivolous appeal under 1-206 if, in fact, the meeting was canceled. I respectfully submit that this appeal was timely filed and ask the commission to rule on the important substantive question. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Boyd.
Good afternoon. I've been listening here, and Mr. Michalski seems to have turned the normal procedures on its head. Jurisdiction is a threshold question, and the hearing officer appropriately found that there is no jurisdiction here because of the events and when the meeting was posted. You heard clear acknowledgement. There was an awareness of the meeting, an effort to figure it out, all of which triggered in Mr. Michalski the right to file a complaint in a timely manner. I will concede that as a misguided courtesy, the Board of Education did say, you know, we're not going to raise the issue of timeliness. What we now realize, of course, is that that wasn't our decision to make. The jurisdiction of the commission is spelled out in the statute, and it's simply a flight of imagination to say that this was a secret meeting. We have emails from Mr. Michalski contesting the posting before it happens, and this is in the record. This is first the meeting was properly posted, as the hearing officer found. That was complainant Exhibit B. And complaining Exhibit C is Mr. Michalski's attempt to school the Board of Ed on what the law says. And that was before the meeting, so it was acknowledged, here's this meeting scheduled. I want to tell you you're wrong, and this is how you're wrong. The board responded, as Mr. Michalski just testified, or just argued. The board responded and explained its position. Mr. Michalski then just has now told you he went to the place where he thought the meeting was going to be, and he couldn't find it. And this is, you know, the Board of Ed lives to serve the public, and there was a communication issue, and that affected our decision making in terms of affording a courtesy which was not the board's to give. And then we come back to the jurisdictional issue, which the hearing officer properly raised on her own, and that is that Mr. Michalski, through the evidence, admits, I got the posting, I thought it was bad, I told them it was bad, they responded, I went, I tried to get to the meeting, I couldn't get to the meeting. This all happened prior to January, or on or before January 26th. The complaint was filed on March 14th. So we hope that our courtesy doesn't complicate this issue, but we do believe that having been duly informed through the hearing officer's decision, this is fundamentally an issue of jurisdiction, and that the hearing officer properly ruled that Mr. Michalski was on notice, the meeting was properly posted, he acknowledged he tried to get to the meeting and he couldn't. Those are the prerequisites for a denial of a meeting. And to somehow say that because we didn't answer his email, it was a secret meeting when it was properly posted, Mr. Michalski was notified and tried to get to the meeting and was unsuccessful. To say that's a secret meeting or an unnoticed meeting, that's simply not correct. It was a meeting. It was held. We did argue the case on the merits. Those merits are not before you today. The question for you is jurisdiction and the Darien Public Schools beliefs that the hearing officer properly raised the issue of jurisdiction sua sponte and properly dismissed the complaint.
Attorney Mooney, was the meeting held in the room that was on the notice?
I don't know. It wasn't. What we have in the record is Mr. Michalski. Well, it was a meeting held by Zoom, I think. I'm going to get the posting. It is scheduled for the administrative officers. But it was the record also includes Mr. Michalski's complaint that he went to the Zoom link on the meeting and he got a blank screen. So I just don't know this room 300 and 100. I don't know the details of that. I do know the meeting was held. There was testimony about the nature of the meeting, what was discussed in the executive session within the bounds of privilege. And we heard from Mr. Michalski that he tried to get to the meeting and he couldn't. And that is all in the record.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
No, I would just comment that, that the town of Darien can't confer jurisdiction upon us when none exists. And we are a nuisance creature of statute. So our powers don't extend beyond our statutes. I think that's the second time I said that today. In another case, yeah. but we don't, we can't go beyond the statute. Something we need to hear from the hearing officer.
Yeah, we would like to hear from.
Yeah, I mean, and also it's noted that it was properly noticed in paragraph 4.
Good afternoon.
I just have a question before you begin. So was the meeting held in the room that was noticed?
There was not testimony specifically that was held in the room that it was noticed. There was testimony that it was held in person and people did attend in person. So there were other options for it was in person as well as remote.
And Mr. Michalski said he couldn't get it on Zoom. Was there?
I don't think there's any dispute that the YouTube link was not functioning properly, but the public, as I understand the notice requirement, it's not personal to an individual. It's that was their notice to the public, and yes, there was, and people did attend that meeting that was in person.
Others were able to attend.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And then just briefly, obviously, as to subject matter jurisdiction, it can't be waived by the party. If we either have jurisdiction under the statute or we don't, and here we did not because I don't believe under the statute that it was unnoticed or secret as those terms are used.
Any other questions for Green Miller?
I don't claim it was a secret meeting, but I do believe that the commission must have the ability to determine what unnoticed means in the statute. And that if the notice says that you may witness this meeting at this location and then is actually not there, that notice is no longer an effective notice for someone who wants to attend that meeting. Because again, the purpose of attending it is to know whether you have actual or constructive notice that the meeting occurred. And so that you do have the power to say that if in fact a meeting does not occur in the place that the public is told to go, the burden then shifts, at least for this limited purpose, of whether someone can appeal it based upon not having yet had the actual or constructive notice of the meeting occurring. The notice didn't just say, oh, and by the way, you can also, if you feel like it, go and watch it on YouTube. It said those only wishing to view it should go to this location. And actually set them up as three places that the public could view this meeting. You can't be at all three. There was no way there was nothing at the link that I could race down to the town hall to see if, in fact, the meeting was happening. I would guess that has to be within your power to interpret what unnoticed means for purposes of that provision, which extends the appeal procedure. And that if you take my example of a physical meeting, a way that we always used to think about it, you know, I'm going to a room. It says it's going to be in this room, and I show up there, and it's empty. There's nobody there. There's nothing telling me that they've gone somewhere else. I can only presume the meeting isn't occurring, and I didn't hear about it. This is, in our new world of virtual meetings, this is the equivalent. That where there the public agency said the meeting would be, it wasn't. And there's no way for a person showing up at that place to say, a meeting happened. It must be happening someplace else. And we have to adjust what unnoticed means to take into account our virtual world, just as you would. I cannot believe that if what happened was that the meeting had been noticed for room 100, it had been moved to a different room or a different building or somewhere else, and the public had not been told anywhere, there was no note on the door, there was not no anything, that you would say, there was a notice, and the meeting happened, and so we're statutorily bound to say that, you know, you should have just filed your complaint quickly, even though you had no evidence whatsoever. No responses to the email, nothing posted online for 30 days. I mean, interestingly, that it was 30 days that they then responded to the email for the first time. So I think you must have that ability to determine what unnoticed means for the limited purpose of that extended appeal period.
Commissioner, just for the record, I would note that I think that's a compelling argument if there was not public access in person. So I think that falls short in an analogy when the public did have the right to access it in person and people did so. So it's not as if Zoom was the only way to get in and it didn't work, I think that's a different matter. And I find Mr. Mahalski's position compelling, but here under the circumstances, I think that wouldn't apply.
I have a question. I'm sorry. So what I'm struggling with here is public access mean, I don't know the answer. Mean generally the public can be there, or I as a member of public who's interested in being there can't be there because the place, the Zoom, which I was relying on going to, and other technology that may come in the future, I might be relying on that, but the time I find out it's not available, I can't go. Other public members might have found it and been there. So I'm struggling with this. Does public access mean some public people showing up? Or public access mean everyone who theoretically had been given a notice of where it's held, being able to show, and their inability to show was caused by the agency, mechanical error, technical error? How do we distinguish those two questions in the future and in this case?
I would submit that it's not personal. I would submit that it is public access. It's a notice provision. Does the public have notice? Is this a meeting unnoticed, right? In the sense of, is the public generally aware? It is not attached to the individual. You can't say, I didn't have notice for some reason, particularly whereas here.
I got mistaken notice. Yes. It was not my fault that I had bad notice.
Right, but this is a circumstance.
I don't know what happened. You're specifically, I take everybody, but hypothetically as a precedent here, to the extent, or is this not precedent for that issue? Are we going up the wrong trail?
May I speak to that?
Yes,
yes, please.
When we look at the statute, it says any person wrongfully denied the right to attend a meeting. And I think this goes
just directly. Any person, right?
You just yes, to... any person wrongfully denied the right to attend any meeting of a public agency may appeal therefrom to the Freedom of Information Commission. And that's what triggers the timeline that is jurisdictional in nature. So if a notice is defective and a meeting is held, a person was denied notice, and thereby would, in a timely manner, be able to claim that he or she was denied access to the meeting. But that issue is unrelated to the commission's jurisdiction. That and the testimony here is absolutely clear. Mr. Michalski was unaware of the meeting. He tried to get to the meeting. He couldn't get to the meeting. All the
day we're not ruling on that issue.
Correct. The issue is jurisdiction.
Clarify that a little more, because that's very important clarification for me. If and then we're not ruling on the issue of any person not being able to enter, or some people being. We're ruling on some other jurisdictional question, which precedes.
I think the complaint is triggered when Mr. Michalski, as any other complainant, was denied access to the meeting. That would trigger the right to file a complaint because he was aware of the meeting. And, you know, if it were a secret meeting, that's one thing. Yeah. And then the constructive notice requirement is triggered. But this was not a secret meeting. It was posted. It was argued about beforehand. It was argued about afterwards. So Mr. Michalski has a right when he's denied access to that meeting to file a complaint. But your jurisdiction is that that filing must be made within 30 days. So it was not in this case.
You're saying, and it's helpful, please, that's the issue, the jurisdictional issue.
Correct.
Not the larger issue of that somehow got in here.
Yes, that I agree that the issue is strictly one of jurisdiction.
Can you just go through that one? I'm just a country lawyer. One or two sentences on why that's
yes.
Positive, and I read your I'd like to feel comfortable, and then we'll deal with all these other sounds like later, because there'll be further cases on. But yes.
Public has a right to attend a meeting, and public agencies have to notify them of the meetings in advance in accordance with statute. That was done in this case. Mr. Michalski claims he was denied access to the meeting. He also claims that the meeting was improper in terms of the scope. The right to file a complaint was perfected at that moment. And we have in evidence his complaint the very day after the meeting. I tried to get to the meeting and I couldn't. At that point, his claim was perfected. Your jurisdiction is to consider such claims as long as they're filed within 30 days of the denial.
And that claim? It was not filed within 30 days.
So I think that the denial with Attorney Mooney, I think I don't agree with his explanation of the denial of access to the meeting. What I'm arguing is all of the public was denied access to a meeting because it was held in an improper executive session. The denial of access was when they held it in an executive session. This is a narrower issue, which is, as to the right of appeal, the question is, was it an unnoticed meeting? And it goes to the question of whether when did the complainant have constructive or actual notice that the meeting was held, that the improper executive session was held. So everyone was denied access to this meeting improperly, I would argue. And now the only question is, I, as a complainant, when I tried to determine if the meeting, in fact, was held, because I don't have a right to file a complaint unless the meeting was held. And if I filed a complaint for a meeting that wasn't held, that to me might be frivolous. There was all of the evidence said the meeting didn't happen. From my perspective, as a member of the public, I went to a place where there was supposed to be a meeting, and there was no meeting there. I tried to reach out. There was no response. I looked for minutes. The
there was nothing on the website posted. Regular meeting came at the meeting that happened right after it. There was no mention of the fact that they had just held an executive session, that they had held a special meeting. There was no evidence the meeting happened, and there was ample evidence that, in fact, the meeting might not have occurred. And so the question under the statute is, was it unnoticed for the purpose of me filing an appeal and having actual and constructive notice? So in a sense, what you are ruling is, in this world of technology, where a board says you can be at the meeting here, or you can be at the meeting here, or you can do it the old-fashioned way and drag yourself down to town hall, that if you could make it to one of those places, if they were right in one of those, that's good enough. And the people who showed up to the other places, well, tough. As long as you could have gone down to town hall, well, the fact that they told you you could be at this other one, you are now at disadvantage as a member of the public if you want to appeal the denial of, for example, an improper executive session. So I think it is a broader. I think you are making a decision here about the world of technology and what does that mean for whether a notice is a good notice if, in fact, where they tell you you can be, you can't. And the question is, shouldn't it be that a public agency has the burden when they realize, oops, we said there would be a meeting at this place and there wasn't. We need to let people know that it happened, even for the very limited purpose of a person having the right to bring an appeal within 30 days.
My final word would simply be that I think that the question is notice and not access. As Attorney Mooney said, there was clear notice that this meeting was going to occur. It was not a secret meeting. Unfortunately, therefore, we don't have jurisdiction over the frankly interesting legal question that was presented in this case.
Mr. Chairman, I think that it was noticed. It wasn't a secret meeting. To say that you're going to a place when maybe that's something for the legislature, because sitting in your home saying I'm going to a meeting, even though it's virtual, maybe that's one reason to not have them anymore if we're getting back in person, is to no longer have the confusion of, if somebody's not able to get there, if there's some sort of glitch, or they're just technologically incapable of getting there. I know Zoom, you can phone in, you can call in, and you can be video, so there's multiple options, but I think the issue is jurisdictional. 47 days is much greater than 30 days.
It's mathematically correct.
So if you wait 47 days and you're outside the jurisdiction.
Commissioner, I would say it was within 30 days of first knowing that there was a meeting had happened, the first evidence of a meeting.
I've had hearings on this before, so yes, I've ruled against that theory.
Anything further? None, I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the hearing officer report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll call a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Kuzashi?
Yes. Thank you. I learned a lot. Maybe I have to learn more in the future.
Mr. Hankins?
Very important. Yes. Thank you very much. Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
Myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Mooney.
So we're moving now to report on pending appeals. A really brief little report, right?
Very brief. Very brief. Alicia Harmon, counsel to the commission. The town of Avon has appealed. In the case of Town of Avon versus Freedom of Information Commission and Joseph Sastre, we have a notice of appeal, but that's all we have so far. That was timely filed. When I get the actual appeal papers, I will further report, maybe at the next meeting. And the oral argument in Drum versus FOI Commission goes forward a week from today, and that's all I have.
That's at
Eastern Connecticut State University, yes.
Great. Is it going to be filmed?
I don't know. I don't know.
Is there Zoom?
I'm going to ask about that.
I don't plan to record it.
Yes, I think it's open.
Yep. So I'll be, sharing my time with the Yale students are representing the complainant, so we're splitting our time. So it will be a third year Yale law student and me, and then on the other side, counsel for Madison Police Department. I think it's going to be a good argument. I think it's going to be a tough argument. I have my moot court on Friday. I'm looking forward to that. So I will be as ready as I can possibly be for these things.
Good luck.
Thank you.
We rule in your favor.
Let's see. Thank you, Felicia. Executive Director's report. I don't have much to report under that. Status of our operations. We're just continuing on here.
Do we ever have technical issues?
Yes.
I know we kind of bend over backwards if somebody's not there trying to get them.
Right. Certainly in our hearings while we were doing them remotely, we had a lot of issues. I mean, not a lot.
I mean, generally, yeah, we would also, if something happened, we'd reconsider it at a future meeting.
Always.
You know,
yes.
But we really just.
Yeah. Something happened. And, you know, for our meetings now, we're fully in person, but as a courtesy, we're allowing people to just listen in, but there wouldn't be an FOI violation for us. That's just an added courtesy. So I'm not sure of the particular circumstances in that other case.
There were other, you know, say municipal that where they have public input where there would be a section they wouldn't be allowed, you know, in that way. But we don't have that in our. So
you'd like to.
No, because that adds just another dimension.
Right. You know.
I love
that,
listening,
right?
To people talk. So. In circles.
Okay. There's really anything else to report. Our staff reports, we're still working on our Secretary One hire, and we're going to do some second round interviews beginning next week, I think, at this point. So we should have somebody soon there. The legislative report, nothing yet. It's a little quiet, I think, as we head into the election time, but probably right after the election, we may start to hear some legislative issues. And that's it. I don't have anything under new business either.
No, no. FOI is not a push button election topic.
I don't think so.
That's good. We like being under. Mr. Chairman, I move we adjourn.
Second. Motion's been made in second. I'll take a roll call of those in favor.
Second, there was busy.
Mr. Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fuzeschi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, all in the evening, yes. We'll adjourn.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Will we be recorded?
Take care, John.